Good morning. I'm Queenie Kim, sitting in for Larry Mantle, and you are listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. It's Thursday, December 27th, and good to have you with us today. For this hour of the show, we are going to talk about guns and credit cards. Back in April, the Wall Street Journal published a story about the Parkland shooting, and that sparked credit card companies and banks to talk about possibly tracking gun purchases. This week, the New York Times released a story that takes a deep dive into hundreds of documents, police reports, bank records, and investigator notes to nail down the financial role of credit cards and that they have played in mass shootings in the last decade. And what they found is that since the Virginia Tech attack in 2007, there have been 13 shootings that killed 10 or more people, and in at least 8 of those those 13 shootings, the killers financed their attacks using credit cards. The New York Times article suggests that credit card companies could and should do more to monitor purchases of guns. And here to dive into this debate with us is Kevin Sullivan. He is a president of the Anti-Money Laundering Training Academy, a consulting firm that trains institutions to identify suspicious spending activity. Kevin has also been a police officer for 22 years, and he served on a governmental agency that tracks money laundering. Hey, Kevin.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. We also have Josh Blackman. He's associate professor of law at South Texas College of Law in Houston, where his expertise includes the intersection of law and technology. Hi, Josh.
Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming on. We have James Wester on the line. He is a research director at International Data Corporation. That's a market research firm that works with credit card companies on the tech and software side of things. Hey, James.
Hi there.
And last but not least, on the line with us, we have Wall Street Journal reporter Telos Demos. Sorry about that, Telos. He's been looking into this role of the role that the finance industry plays in these mass shootings. Welcome, Telos.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us. I wanted to start with you. I know you work for the Wall Street Journal, and this story was done in the New York Times, but this is an issue you flagged all the way back in April. And in that article, you said that credit card companies are getting ready for this, this idea being that they might have to identify purchases of guns in their payment systems. And it's a move that you said could be a prelude to restricting such transactions in the future. Tell me how you even got onto this story and why there was already this buzz all the way in April.
So it really came in the wake of a couple of things. One was the Parkland shooting, which sparked an unusual amount of discussion among activists and policymakers about steps that non-sort of government steps that could be taken by people who believe that gun control should be tighter. On the idea that it was unlikely that laws would change and it would take some time. So are there private ways to better restrict or monitor gun sales? And one of the focuses was on the financial services industry. The financial services industry plays a role in all kinds of sort of policing, both on behalf of the government and also just there are some activities that they consider risky that they limit, right? There are banks are supposed to monitor transactions to see if there's any evidence that, you know, a bank is being used to launder money on behalf of a terrorist or otherwise criminal organization. And banks have also taken steps to restrict how you can use your bank-issued credit card to buy things like Bitcoin, which is illegal, but in some cases – which is legal, I'm sorry, but in some cases controversial. So and then the other thing that prompted that conversation was that some banks – a couple of banks made some moves to change their own policies about who they would do business with in the gun business. And so a couple of banks made decisions to restrict the business that they would do with certain kinds of merchants who sold guns, fully automatic weapons, other kind of controversial guns, and then also retailers that sold guns to minors, to people who were under 18 or under 21. And so those moves also prompted, I think, a focus on the financial services industry.
Yeah, what I found so interesting about this article, I remember hearing those notions of the big banks sort of taking on, you know, big gun makers or big companies that sell guns. But this is really drilling into the individual level of how the actual killers, these shooters, are getting using these credit cards to finance these mass shootings. Can you break that down for us a little bit, how that works?
Sure. So banks play are not the only player in the world of purchases, right? Like when you your bank issues you a credit card, right? So but that credit card works on a card network like Visa or MasterCard. And then there are many other intermediaries there. There are what are called acquiring firms that help connect the bank, your bank, where you send the money to the retailer's bank. So there's a lot of different players in the ecosystem of payments. And so while a bank could say, okay, we're not going to lend money to a retailer that we think doesn't follow good practices with gun sales, it's not nearly as clear what they could do about cutting off sales to use of a credit card for a gun, right? So if a minor had a credit card and they wanted to buy a gun, or if the bank decided even more generally that they didn't want their credit cards used to buy guns, could they even restrict that? Because the bank doesn't necessarily see what you purchase. Some of that information the bank might see, depending on how it's set up. And then they might only have certain information about the merchant, right? Like where you shop, you know, you might be shopping at a big store, like a sporting goods store that sells many things, and you might buy a gun there. The bank just knows that you shopped at a sporting goods store. You might buy a gun at a gun merchant, but that gun merchant might not be called, you know, Bob's Guns. It might have another name that the bank doesn't readily identify as a gun seller. So the banks don't necessarily really have the full as powerful
a full
as
view.
As they
yeah,
are.
So we got to sort of rely on these credit card companies,
the full,
right?
Exactly.
To go to the individual
level. There's a coordination that happens that would have to happen between all of these companies in order for that information to become more clear.
So we're going to get a little bit into the logistics of this, but I wanted to bring on Kevin Sullivan from the consulting firm Anti-Money Laundering Training Academy into this conversation here. And Kevin, I was hoping you could sort of connect some of the dots here in terms of how this would work and how it would help law enforcement. I'm thinking of the anecdote that was in the story about James Holmes. He's the man who killed 12 people and injured 70 others at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. And I'm wondering if you could sort of connect those dots to me, how he used a credit card to finance that shooting and what that might have told law enforcement.
Well, I understand that there's a system in place already for finance institutions to give law enforcement a heads up. All finance institutions are mandated already by law to report suspicious activity and any cash transaction over $10,000 on a currency transaction report, or suspicious activity on a suspicious activity report.
And that's if they're, like, trying to bring in and out large amounts of money.
Right. So, for example, banks already have, again, in place, something called Know Your Customer. They already know who you are. They know how much you spend. They know what you get because you've been a customer for 5 years. They know what you make. They know your income. They know what you spend for your car. They know how much your mortgage is. They have what they call a financial profile.
So what you're saying, I mean, am I hearing you correctly in saying that from your point of view, this isn't a heavy lift for banks, that this is actually something that they can do and track these more minute level of transactions?
Yeah. I'm not for one set suggesting that they should create policy anti or for guns. All I'm saying is it's already in place that they can notify you if somebody does something that's out of the ordinary. So if you, for example, were to go tomorrow and buy and max out your credit cards, your three credit cards, mm-hmm. $10,000 each, and load up on guns and ammunition, that should be notified. That would be an easy one to notify law enforcement. Law enforcement would get it and then begin an investigation on that.
Yeah, and I wanted to sort of drill into this James Holmes story here. I guess before the shooting, he had quit his job, filed for unemployment, and then he opened some new MasterCards to buy more than $11,000 in weapons. This is according to the New York Times story, in military gear. He bought, like, I don't know, Glock handguns, AR-15, I don't even know half of these things, a bulletproof vest, 5,000 rounds of ammunition. These were all points of purchases on his MasterCard. What is the idea here? If law enforcement knew that, then what?
If law enforcement knew that, if you know, the bank who pulls the credit card, if they had notified law enforcement that this individual who now makes nothing, He doesn't appear to be working. And in his lifetime.
You know, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have started that question. I'm going to interrupt you right now. I'm going to bring that back right when we get back. You're listening to Air Talk. We are talking about the role of credit cards in mass shootings. We're going to be back with this discussion in a second. I'm Queenie Kim, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Stay with us. I'm Queenie Kim, sitting in for Larry Mantle, and you're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. If you're just joining us, we are talking about the role credit card companies play in mass shootings. There's an article out in the New York Times this week connecting the dots between 13 of the biggest mass shootings over the last decade and 8 of them. It turns out that credit cards helped refinance the shooting. If you have any questions for our guests or if you have any comments, please call us at 866-893-5722. If you want to weigh in on should credit card companies call out these problematic gun purchases, or if you have some Second Amendment issues with this, give us a call, 866-893-5722. When we left off last time, we were speaking to Kevin Sullivan. He's from the consulting firm Anti-Money Laundering Training Academy. He was connecting some of the dots for us in the New York Times article. Namely, there was a bit in the article talking about James Holmes. He was part of the man who shot up the movie theater in the Aurora, Colorado, killing 12 people. Turns out he had quit his job and used his MasterCard to buy more than $11,000 in weapons just before the shooting. And James, I was wondering if you could continue connecting those dots for us. So you see all these transactions. What does law enforcement do with this? How would this work?
Once the bank sees that, and now here's a guy now on unemployment benefits, he's no longer getting a paycheck, and he's a person who probably should be more concerned with paying his rent and food on the table, and suddenly out of the blue, he spends $11,000 on weapons. Now, I don't care what side of the debate you sit on, that has to be considered a little odd and unusual.
And then, so the idea is if they tipped off the local police enforcement, they might be able to go and search his apartment? Or what would be the legal recourse after that moment of information?
For the banks or for the law enforcement?
Yeah, for the law enforcement. So you get a tip-off from the bank. Hey, this guy just bought $11,000 worth of ammo, and he's unemployed. What legal recourse can the police department take from that point?
Well, based on the suspicious activity, that gives us probable cause to go and talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
So we could send a couple of investigators out to talk to this guy, and you might show up there, and you find out that he's an emotional mess.
Mm-hmm.
You look in his apartment, and he's got an arsenal in his bedroom, and he's an emotional disaster. So that you might be able to drag him in and have him involuntarily committed. But certainly, you're going to get a heads up on what's going on there. And we don't want this guy that's an emotional issue and have access to that kind of weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
Look, if a guy wants to kill somebody, it's not that difficult to run him over with a truck or stab him. But we certainly don't want a guy with a tank in his backyard. So law enforcement would have had that heads up. They could have went out, and I'm not saying it would have happened, but it could have happened.
Yeah, and I would love to, because there's obviously some privacy issues here, and I would love to bring in Josh Blackman. He's an associate professor of law at South Texas College of Law in Houston, and his expertise includes the intersection of law and technology. And Professor Blackman, you come from this from a slightly different perspective, that's of consumer privacy. What are your concerns here?
Well, thank you again for having me on.
No, thanks for joining us.
The article suggested that there were, 8 of the
13 shootings of, were 10 or more people were killed.
All these credit card numbers. There have been hundreds of thousands of people who have purchased guns with credit cards who didn't engage in that sort of crime. We were talking about such a small number of people who use credit cards. When I walk to a store, I usually don't carry cash with me. I usually bring a credit card instead of cash. The sort of approach that the prior guest mentioned would result in police harassing lots of people who have no grounds to be harassed. There's nothing suspicious about people buying guns with a credit card.
Yeah, and I don't know that the article suggests that they should track, they should go after anybody who buys guns with credit cards. I think what was a tip-off in at least many of the anecdotes that was used in argument, that they were such huge purchases. I think the man who shot up the Country Music Festival in Las Vegas. It was something like $90,000, if I'm remembering that correctly, in credit card purchases for ammunition. I think the point they were trying to make was these huge purchases. I guess the argument would be you don't have to worry about it if you're just buying a one-off gun. It's just if you're making these sort of big purchases that stand out. What would be your comment to that?
People don't need the government's permission or inspection to purchase lawful products. These guns are lawfully owned. And perhaps a person was saving up for a long time to buy them and decided to buy them for a Christmas or a holiday or something else. But the end result of this is it will result in harassment. With respect to my previous guest, there's not probable cause to inspect someone because they bought a lot of guns. It's a law-abiding process. They go through a background check. In each of the cases where there were these mass killings, these people emitted red flags left and right, and they weren't able to discuss it. The upshot of these sorts of regimes is deliberate, is to stigmatize gun owners and make it harder for them to obtain access to credit. The more important aspect is if credit card companies stop providing services to gun buyers, you basically put an entire segment out of business, which I think is the ultimate purpose. This is why gun control groups are pushing Bank of America and other groups to stop offering services to certain gun distributors. So we should be very careful what's going on here. We should look at this perspective of consumer privacy, that you're now inspecting people's purchases, but also this is designed to kill an industry and will harass far more people with a very, very low probability that they'll actually detect the sort of person who engaged in these horrific acts of mass violence. Not every step that can be taken by law enforcement need be taken because there are lots of collateral consequences for people who pose no harm to others.
So, Josh Blackman, let's say that somehow legislation does go through where credit card companies are asked to track these kind of large purchases. Would there be any constitutional issues here?
Well, you mentioned earlier in your program the Second Amendment. I don't actually know if the Second Amendment is the leading problem. I think the bigger problem here is actually one of consumer privacy. You're basically scrutinizing what people purchase and why they purchase in the exercise of a constitutional right. And I can just give your listeners an example. Let's say a state, Texas, passes a law that says we want to report any citizen who pays for an abortion with a credit card or an HSA or whatever you want, right? Does that prevent the person from getting the abortion? No, they can still purchase it, but now it goes in some list, and maybe the state will mail them literature about adoption or something of that nature.
So your point here is that it's a very slippery slope. We might start with something like this, but who knows where it'll end up, and depending on where you are in the political spectrum, there will be something that will be objectionable that you don't want people to track. And I was wondering, if I wanted to pass this back to Kevin Sullivan, I'm wondering how you would respond to what Professor Blackman is saying about this idea being designed to kill an entire industry.
Well, the slippery slope argument is always the one that's used. And I just want to make a comment that the police are not there to harass people. They're there to investigate potential crimes and there to protect people. In the situation, what he's not saying there is there's a background. There's building blocks to this case with Holmes. It wasn't just a guy who walked in off the street and bought some guns. I mean, there's a background here. Background that he quit his job. He's acting irrationally. Should the bank have known that, what he did financially? Why does a guy on unemployment doing – he's not buying his Christmas presents. There's a guy on unemployment benefits buying $10,000 worth of guns. And I would say that's an unusual activity.
So I think your point is that this data point wouldn't be used in isolation. But since there was much known about this fellow, that there would have been many data points that would have led the police to maybe go and intervene. It wouldn't just be this data point alone. And I'm wondering, James Wester, your research director at International Data Corporation, where you work with a lot of credit card companies and on the tech and software side of stuff. How easy would this be to do for credit card companies to track individual purchases, like the actual thing you're purchasing?
Yeah, that would be the big question. And that's where, regardless of what side you come down on this, from a political or a Second Amendment standpoint, unfortunately, it would be an incredibly difficult thing to do. As Telus mentioned at the beginning of the show, there is not just a credit card company. A merchant connects to their merchant bank or a payment processor. They connect into – you have a point of sale. You have the networks. You have merchant or card issuers. You have all of these different companies that make that transaction happen. And they pass along very small amounts of data, very small amounts, because we're talking about billions of transactions and trillions of dollars. So from an efficiency standpoint, they just pass along a very small message. The merchants themselves are also really very unhappy about the idea of passing along what's called SKU-level data, which is the actual information that says what an item is. All they're willing to pass along is the transaction information and, you know, that somebody is buying something and what that amount is. That way the card issuer at the other end can approve it or not. They're not going to pass along a lot of information that you were talking about, the data points that would be used together to come to some sort of a profile. That's just not being passed along. And if you require, if Visa or MasterCard, who are the rulemaking bodies for these transactions, were to come along and say, you have to pass this along first, the merchants themselves, who are their customers, would say, no, we don't really want to do that. Then you would also have to change all the systems along the way to make that happen. It's not a simple tweak. It's not a simple
It's not just a one button thing. Well, we are going to return to this conversation after the break. But if you have any questions for our guests, or if you want to weigh in, should credit card companies call out these problematic gun purchases, give us a call. We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. We'll return to this conversation after the break. I'm Queen Akim, sitting in for Larry Mantle, and you're listening to Air Talk. We'll be right back. I'm Queen Akim, sitting in for Larry Mantle, and you're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. If you are just joining us, we are looking into the role credit cards play in mass shootings. The New York Times took a deep dive into this subject and found that since the Virginia Tech attack in 2007, there have been 13 shootings that killed 10 or more people. And in at least 8 of those 13 shootings, the killers financed their attacks using credit cards. We are talking to Kevin Sullivan. He's the president of the Anti-Money Laundering Training Academy. That's a consulting firm that trains institutions to identify suspicious spending activity. We're also talking to Josh Blackman, associate professor of law at South Texas College of Law in Houston, a Wall Street Journal reporter Telos Demos, and James Wester, who's a research director at the International Data Corporation. That's a market research firm that works with credit card companies on the tech and software side of things. And I wanted to go back to you, Telos. When you did your story in April about this issue, you spoke to a lot of the heads of these credit card companies and the banks. They seem to be really hesitant to, very afraid of the subject and also the political blowback that might they might incur. Can you talk a little bit about what you heard from them?
Well, I think that at the time, like I said, banks had made a couple of a couple of banks, Citigroup and Bank of America, had made some moves to restrict what kinds of gun retailers they did business with. In Citigroup's case, it was retailers that sold guns to people underage or didn't have background check policies. And in Bank of America's case, it was retailers who sold a certain class of sort of military grade guns. And in both those cases, it engendered an enormous amount of sort of political discussion, including a lot of scrutiny and concern from people on the political right who believe in sort of, you know, full access to guns or wider access to guns. And in Citigroup's case, they had gotten letters and inquiries from senators and were certainly hearing about it from Republicans in Washington. And so I think banks and credit card companies were very aware of the political context around this. And, you know, some people in Washington said, look, like it's up to us to decide what's legal and what's not. It's not the bank's decision to decide that a legal purchase is not a good purchase. And so therefore, you know, banks were sort of, you know, usurping lawmakers' sort of powers to decide what was legal and what was not. Then again, on of course, on the other side of the spectrum, you know, people were saying that banks needed to be doing more, that they needed to be playing a more active role in sort of policing the payment system, again, in the same way that they do in other spheres, like with money that might be going to terrorist organizations.
Yeah, and in October, Senator John Kennedy, he's a Republican from Louisiana, he actually introduced a bill that would prohibit the federal government from giving contracts to banks that discriminate against lawful businesses based solely on a social policy consideration. And so that's a little bit of a blowback you're getting from sort of some of the more right-leaning pro-gun lawmakers. But we've got a call here from Natalie in Long Beach. Hey, Natalie, welcome to Air Talk.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. You got a question or comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the gentleman that was speaking before the pledge break. I absolutely think that it's okay for credit card companies to be able to monitor these types of things because, I mean, there's absolutely no reason for anybody to be purchasing that amount of ammunition, whether or not it's on a credit card legally or whatnot. There's just no reason for it.
And I think that might be an answer, a question for Josh Blackman, or if you wanted to respond to that. I think there's a certain feeling that common sense tells us you don't really need that many weapons. And if you do, there might be something happening here. What would your response to that be?
I think the caller needs to have more friends who have guns. If you meet people who have large collections of firearms, there are lots of these people. They exist. They're your friends and neighbors, and they don't go off killing people in mass shootings. States have enacted laws that say you can only buy a gun every 10 days. You have to have waiting periods. If the state thinks owning that many firearms is a problem, then they can limit the number of firearms you can buy. But allowing this standard to be imposed is purely arbitrary, that some algorithm says, wow, this is strange. Maybe this person is doing something dangerous. Let's send the cops to talk to them. That takes pre-crime a bit too far. If your problem is people owning guns, just restrict the guns themselves. Don't shut down the financial intermediaries who harass innocent people.
And in fact, there is a law on the books, isn't there? I think I read about it. It's that you can only buy a certain number of guns every year or within a certain amount of time. Do you know what the thinking behind that law was?
Well, the thinking is if someone has some sort of emotional trauma, you want to create a cooling-off period before they can then go ahead and purchase another gun. I think California has a 10-day waiting period, although I'm not positive on that law.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think I'm thinking of the Gun Control Act of 1968, and it says firearm dealers must report if someone buys two or more handguns in a span of 5 business days. Is that the same one you're referring to right now?
Right. There's a federal law, the one you mentioned a moment ago, and also states have laws as well. For example, California, that limit how many guns you can buy with waiting periods. But again, there are lots of Americans who own many, many guns. You'd be surprised if you come down to Texas how things go, and they have no intent to ever harm others. And this sort of regime or law would merely stigmatize and harass law-abiding citizens who wish to use their hard-earned money in the way they see fit.
And Kevin Sullivan, you were in law enforcement for 22 years. What is your response to that? Lots of people buy a lot of guns. Is it just that we don't know any of them?
No. I mean, I have no problem with people buying lots of guns. Well, I have a problem is that you're not attaching anything else prior to that. What is his motivation? A guy just got fired from his job and suddenly goes out to the gun store and buys a lot of guns. You know what? It doesn't take a genius to figure out maybe there's something wrong with that picture. You know, maybe this guy's going to do something bad. So you got to attach the other and environmental issues around it. It's not just a matter of a guy walking in and buying a couple of guns. I mean, I'm fine with that. But I'm not fine if he's got a whole background or history or something else has happened in the environment to this guy that makes it might make a big difference. And I think that's what we're forgetting to look at here. That's what makes it unusual or odd, not the fact he just walked in and bought some guns, but the fact that he just got fired from his job or he just got a divorce and he lost everything in a divorce, you know, and he's walking in and buying a gun. That is an added component that we need to look at.
So it's context is everything again. We've got a comment from Nathan and Marina Del Rey who tweeted us and said, I think the Second Amendment should be monitored in the same way driver's licenses are. Require training, testing, and make sure the individuals are suitable to handle a gun. I wanted to sort of get back to this idea of, is this even possible anyways? I mean, you know, do credit card companies and merchants have the ability to do this? And we were talking to James Wester. He's a research director at the International Data Corporation. They work with the technology companies that help these credit card companies. And I'm wondering, James, in this article in the New York Times, they talked about something called the boxcar. And they make the argument that this boxcar allows retailers to tag transactions with extra data. So online retailers are already using this to send banks details about consumer behavior. Why can't you just make a little check on that, or it makes it sound like you can just make a comment on that? And we got about 30 seconds for this. I'm wondering, is this possible? Is it that simple?
No, it's not that simple. The problem is that you have 5,000 card issuers, you have hundreds of merchant acquirers and payment processors, and millions of merchants. So the idea that you could just, say, flip a switch here, it actually is going to require all of them to change all of their systems. And that's you're not going to get all of them to operate together to do that short of having a regulation or a law in place. Visa and MasterCard simply can't do that.
So lots of moving parts. Well, there's a lot more to talk about here, but this is the end of our segment. I wanted to thank my panel on of guests for this hour. They were Kevin Sullivan, he's the president of the Anti-Money Laundering Training Academy. Josh Blackman, associate professor of law at South Texas College of Law in Houston. Wall Street Journal reporter Telus Demos. And James Wester, who's a research director at International Data Corps. I'm Queen Akim, sitting in for Larry Mantle today. And stay tuned for more Air Talk in the next hour. Good morning. I'm Queen Akim, sitting in for Larry Mantle today, and you are listening to Air Talk. And in this hour of the show, we are going to be looking at who moves in and out of California. We've got expensive housing. You sit in traffic for hours. There's the fires, the floods, the earthquakes. And then, of course, there are the taxes. Everything from a gallon of milk to a gallon of gas just costs more in California. So, yes, the weather is great, but with all these factors, who in their right mind would want to live here? Turns out, a lot of people. According to a newly released survey from the U.S. Census Bureau for 2017, despite the fact that there are more people leaving California than arriving here from other states, California still attracts a steady stream of people. And despite the fact that we've been hearing about people leaving California, California's overall population has actually gone up. That's in part because of the number of births, which are still outnumbering the number of deaths, and a rise in immigrants from China, India, and other Asian nations. Here to talk about all this with us are our guests. We've got Margot Roosevelt. She's a reporter for the LA Times covering California economic, labor, and workplace issues. And she recently wrote an article on these numbers. Hey, Margo.
Hi.
And we've also got Dow Myers on the phone with us. He's a demographer and an urban planner. He's also a public policy professor at USC. Hey, Dow, welcome.
Well, thanks for bringing me in.
Yeah, and before I start this conversation, I wanted to invite folks to join here. I wanted to give us our number. It's 866-893-5722. If you are a new transplant to L.A., call us and tell us why you moved here. If you are from L.A. and want to move out, call us at 866-893-5722 and tell us why you want to leave the Golden State. Or maybe you're an Angeleno and you're like, there's no way I'm leaving California. Well, then call us and tell us why. 866-893-8722. So while we're waiting for your phone calls, let's start the conversation. Margo, you took a look at the latest numbers from the U.S. Census about California migration. And even though the number of people, as we mentioned, moving out is larger than the people who remain, you notice that there are two distinctive groups here, and they have two major differences. They have one major difference, the people moving out and people moving in, and that is their educational levels. Can you talk about that finding a little bit?
The lower income people and lower and less educated, less than college educated group is moving out in much higher numbers, and that's obviously because the cost of living is so high, and they you know, if you're a construction worker, you can move to Arizona, you can move to Nevada and find exactly the same job there, but your house will, your rent will be much less expensive and your cost of living much less expensive. Whereas if you're a, you know, a graduate, you know, in computer science, California is the place to be, and you can afford the housing.
And what sort of professionals are you seeing moving into the Golden State? Is it the, you know, the tech industry that's driving this influx?
You really see everything. I mean, my article, you know, pointed out that there's a lot. There are a lot of entertainment people moving into Los Angeles. People are interested in working in the movie business, in the television business, also technology. And there's financial people, you know, working at banks and working at, you know, companies that that buy and sell people in real estate. There's really, it's across the board.
Well, we want to hear from our listeners right now. I would love if you would call in right now at 866-893-5722 if you are a new transplant to LA, or if you're native to Angelina who doesn't want to leave. But if you are a new transplant, I'm wondering what brought you here. Was it the weather? Was it a job, as these numbers have found out? Or what else? Give us a call, 866-893-5722. Let's go to you. I'm sorry, Dowell. You're a demographer, and I'm wondering, you know, we've been hearing a lot about the brain drain in rural areas and what havoc they're causing in those areas as they're trying to recover economically. It seems like we're getting a lot of that brain drain, and that should be a good thing, but I imagine there's some unintended consequences there. What does a state look like if it's mostly just educated professionals?
Well, it's not fair if we hog all the talent in America, is it? but California really is the big magnet. It really is the destination that draws people from across the country and across the globe, because we have the most specialized jobs, the best opportunities, the highest paying jobs, settled with the highest housing prices, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But leaving that aside for the moment, it's a place to advance your career. So young people come here. Not older people. People under 35, they're the ones who are footloose and trying to get a big start in their careers, and this is the place to do it. Afterwards, they then fan out, and they might go back out to where they came from, or they might move out to Nevada or Oregon or Arizona. But the place to really establish your big connections in a career is here in either Southern California or in the Bay Area.
So it sort of sounds like that old song, you know, New York, New York, if I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. California is sort of becoming that place a little bit with all these young folks coming in, trying their hand at making it big?
Yeah, it's very much like that. It's like the role that New York used to play. It's really been taken by California. You know, really, the housing prices are the big barrier. Otherwise, we'd have a lot more people wanting to stay here.
And what happens if this trend holds? So you're saying one of the consequences, as we've all felt here, is rising home prices. Everything is just getting more expensive, you know, sort of the supply and demand thing. But if this trend holds, what happens in terms of service and blue-collar workforce? And how will our state function if folks like that can't afford to live here?
Well, you know, I always shake my head when I see a school bus, and I look at who's driving it, and I wonder where they live. Well, they live in some house that they got a long time ago, but they're going to be retiring. And then we're going to have to get some new driver who's at to pay, you know, contemporary prices. I don't know how we're going to get school bus drivers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just one example. But up and down, you can look at restaurants. You can look at in hospitals. There's lots of service workers in there. You can just, you know, look at the plumbers, electricians. They're going to be retiring, too. How do I know this? Well, I'm a demographer, and I like to say that, unlike economists, I can predict the future. Because I know that in 10 years' time, all these people, all these plumbers are going to be 10 years older.
Well, we all age, right? So there's no stopping that. That's something you can easily predict. So, I mean, I guess, have you given much thought? I mean, is this what we're seeing right now with this housing crisis low-wage workers, blue-collar workforce having to live further and further out and adding to their commutes and I guess basically degrading their quality of life. Have you started to spin out what this looks like if we just keep going on this road?
Well, it leads to fewer families with kids. That's one thing.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the economic base of this, do we just still keep going up and up because we have this professional base? Or, you know, or does it at some point become like the scale tips so it's not such a good thing?
Well, I think it'll always work, but it'll work with some contortion. We'll look a lot more like Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
Have a a very wealthy class that's older, and then you have a younger service worker class that is really struggling, and they don't have much economic growth there for lack of workers. Or we'll look more like maybe San Francisco, which is very – it's been contorted inside out, where they actually bus in workers from Silicon Valley to the suburb, which is now – San Francisco is a suburb of Silicon Valley. It's totally inside out. And the people who can live there are people who have the peak earning jobs. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is squeezed out. So that I heard one time in a bar in San Francisco, the waitress there was laughing how around here even the attorneys have roommates.
Right.
Everybody's doubled up.
Yeah, I'm from the Bay and I can attest to that. We've got some comments coming in from the audience here. Gabriel in Echo Park called us and said, I'm from LA, born and raised. On the one hand, I work in the entertainment industry, so my job is here, but I want to own a home, so that makes me want to leave. I'm really torn. Let's just go to call here. We've got Conrad from Atwater Village. Hey, Conrad. Welcome to Air Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. So yeah, basically my big reason for coming is the weather. I'm from the Northeast. I'm from Maryland, so a little bit on the South region. But every day I walk out here, I feel great. It's beautiful every single day. I'd be freezing right now. Like, I just had my dad come visit, and he couldn't believe how nice it was. And this is my first time coming to this region. So really, I chalk any of that extra expense to feeling great and not being freezing at this time of the year.
So it's the weather that brought you here. Well, keep your calls coming. Give us a call at 866-893-5722. We're going to be returning to this segment after the break. I'm Queen of Kim, sitting in for Larry Mantle today, and you are listening to Air Talk. I'm Queen of Kim, sitting in for Larry Mantle, and you're listening to Air Talk. We're talking about a newly released survey from the U.S. Census Bureau for 2017 that shows that despite the fact that more people are leaving California than arriving here from other states, California still attracts a steady stream of people. Here to talk about it with us is L.A. Times Margot Roosevelt and USC demographer Dal Myers. And Margot, I know that we've been talking a lot about the kind of people who are coming into the state, which are often educated professionals. You profiled quite a few people who were leaving the state. And I wanted to ask you to tell me a little bit about Keith Johnson and Sandra Martinez Johnson. They left California looking for that California dream somewhere else. What happened after they left?
Well, they're leaving California to go back to Texas. They originally came from Texas 60 years ago. And yes, they came and they found a good job and they found a place to live. But they really felt squeezed. They couldn't buy a house. And Keith's company had a job open in Houston, and they just decided, we're going to go back because we can live, you know, we can rent a three-bedroom single-family home for $1,750 and a month, and that's a lot cheaper than anything that they could find here in California, and that makes it gives them the ability to save up. I mean, they tried moving to the Inland Empire, but then poor Keith was driving 80 miles a day, you know, and that was just untenable.
And that sort of gets to Dal Myers's comment that a lot of young folks come here to try and make it, and then as they get older and want to buy a house and have families, they tend to move out. We've got a couple of comments here from our listeners. Michael in Alhambra called and said, I moved from D.C. to L.A. for grad school, but mostly it was the attraction of the beach. What people don't understand is that L.A. just looks so beautiful and attractive on TV. That's why people want to come here. HGTV and beautiful beaches. So I guess we've got pretty good marketing here, thanks to Hollywood. We've got a call from Arthur in West Hollywood, and I think he has a different point of view. Hey, Arthur.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for calling. So you moved here from Manhattan?
Yes, I moved here from New York 2 years ago, and what was fascinating to me is I wanted to settle down, I wanted a slower pace, and I wanted a better quality of life. As the size of the apartment, amenities in the apartment, because in Manhattan, like, most of the buildings are built in 1920s.
And they're older.
But yes, but as the time goes, in a single year, my rent for a studio increased $150. And it came to the point that it gets very close to the prices I used to pay in Manhattan, not necessarily Manhattan, but New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, when you compare two cities, LA offers a lot of opportunities, but it's nowhere near as the business centers, the financial situation, or like medium incomes as what Manhattan can offer. So it becomes even more worrying with rent prices going out of control. My rent went up in a single year 15%.
And May, are you in the financial industry? Is that what brought you out here?
I'm not.
Okay.
I am not. I just became a software engineer this year. And quite frankly, I'm now looking into applying for jobs in Austin, Texas, because when you live there, your salary is about the same, but there, you can rent a one-bedroom for $900 to $1,000.
So you're planning your move to Texas. Well, thank you for calling us and sharing your story. Dal Myers, I know that in the newest numbers, it looks like we're getting a lot of people from New York coming to California, although some of them seem to be moving out. I'm wondering if you could talk about that trend, about where people are coming from, what states.
Well, they tend to come from the biggest states because they had the most people to send us. Also, the states that are closest to us. There's a revolving door, so that whatever state we send a lot of people to, we tend to get a lot back from the same state. So you'll see people coming into California from Nevada. Even though we send more that way than reverse, there is a backflow.
Hmm. And are those the same people moving back and forth, or are they different populations?
Can't tell. You know, a lot of it is the same people. They're going back. They try it out and they go back. They go back where they have connections, or they go back where they have somebody they can crash with,
mm-hmm.
literally. So they go back to where they have family members or where they have contacts. Or sometimes they go onward. So they might move from New York to California and then decide, well, let's go up the coast. I hear it's great in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
Move up that way. But L.A. or Hollywood really is the big magnet that draws people. You'll see, if you look in Hollywood area, most of the people living there are not native Californians.
Yeah. They're all, are they mostly trying to make it in the entertainment industry? Is that what we're looking at there?
Oh, no, they just come there because they've heard the name Hollywood, and they just land in that area. Then they move out to the valley after that.
Right. It's a little bit to our caller's point, or one of our listeners' points, that it just looks so beautiful and they want to come out. And LA Times reporter Margot Roosevelt, I was wondering, I think one of the people you profiled did make the move out and then they came back to California?
Well, just going to Dal's point about where people come and go from, I think it's interesting. One of the things, the curious things that popped up in the numbers this year was that departures from California to Texas since 2010 actually dropped by 8%. But the number of Texans moving here went up by 12%.
Wow, that is interesting. What do we...
Are significant numbers. And so what I found talking to a lot of people is that they move back to Texas, but then they realize they really miss the beauty of California. And you talked about how this is a marketing thing, or as the call-in person talked about how it's on television, but it's actually true. We do have gorgeous beaches and fabulous weather, and people move to Texas, and they're not as happy there. And so they look for a way to come back, and that's... I think that's what we're seeing in those numbers, even though, you know, there is this rivalry between California and Texas, and it's kind of a trope in the conservative business community. Oh, you know, all our companies are moving to Texas, and everybody's going to move to Texas. But, you know, actually, Texas sends more people to California than any other state.
So I guess they might be cheaper, but we're more beautiful in California. I'm sure I'll get a lot of angry calls about that, but it sounds like it really is sort of the natural terrain.
Well, as Dal pointed out, it's not just that it's more beautiful. It's that there are more jobs here that are specialized, and the jobs do pay better. So if you're in a particular niche of an industry, you might be more able to find a job here. I mean, Austin is moving up to be a major tech center, so that's, you know, going to mitigate that. But there are a lot of employment opportunities here, too, and they pay pretty well in many cases.
Well, we've got a caller on the line here, Sarah from West Hollywood. Hey, Sarah, welcome to AirTalk.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for listening. I moved here from New York in 2015, and I moved because I was from New York, and the housing was unaffordable there. I lived in a rent-stabilized apartment in the Village, and the landlord was harassing me and getting private eyes to follow me, and subsequently, after I left, the apartment now rents for $5,000, 500 square feet, so that's what he had on mind. I moved here also because, I heard it's a really creative community. I'm a playwright. I know a lot of playwrights were moving out here to work in television, and I did enjoy it when I first moved. I found a lot of creative people, like, let's do this together, let's do that together. But over time, I've grown to really miss New York. I want to move back as soon as I can afford to. A lot of it has to do with the city government. Actually, literally a block that's not West Hollywood, West Hollywood all around me. I'm in Beverly Grove. And a development started, giant construction project across the street. And I watched as they were allowed to find a loophole so that although they tore down affordable housing, they will not be replacing it with affordable housing. And I went to the city planning hearing, and when I started speaking about the problem of homelessness, they started smirking. And I've spoken to my city council person about it, and they're like, yeah, that happens. Basically, they permitted to...
So is the homelessness bothering you, or do you feel like the California isn't doing as much about affordable housing as you saw being done in New York?
Absolutely.
Is that sort of, yeah. It
bothers me on a human level. Mm-hmm. Compassion level, and then to see our council person and our mayor not be able to find a solution despite the fact that we voted in a prop and a measure to provide more funding, and to see them allow this developer to go get building permits saying they're going to replace the affordable housing, and then 14 months into their construction, they were allowed to change that to force.
Great. Well, Sarah, thank you for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Dow Myers, I'm curious. I remember I was in New York in the 90s, around there, and I remember a lot of these same conversations going on. It's unaffordable. It's too many homeless people, that sort of stuff. Is this sort of the part of the growing pains of you know, what California is going through with this more educated workforce and housing going up? Are there some things here that we still have to fix? And is New York any kind of example for us?
I think that California has it worse than New York. I lived in New York 5 years also. I live in Manhattan. It's worse because the Silicon Valley and L.A. think that people who live there think they're living in a suburb. They think they're living in a single-family housing suburb. And they want to keep it that way. And yet they have all this job growth on top of that, which is enormous. And this is a disconnect. There's a mythical, magical, psychological disconnect when you think you are living in a bucolic suburb, and yet you have...
You're in a major city. Well, unfortunately, we got to cut the conversation off there. I want to thank our guests, LA Times' Margot Roosevelt and USC's Dow Myers. Stay tuned for more Air Talk after this break. I'm Queenie Kim, sitting in for Larry Mantle, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Queenie Kim in for Larry Mantle, who is on vacation. We are going to turn our attention right now to the term Latinx, or is it Latinx? We're going to figure that one out. But back in September, the word was officially added to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary as a gender-neutral alternative to Latino or Latina. But who's using this term, and is there a generational divide between who's adopting it and those who oppose it? If you are of Latin American descent and have some thoughts on this word Latinx, or you might be from a different immigrant community and you've seen familiar examples, one I'm thinking of is Asian American and Oriental, call us and weigh in. Tell us what you think. Our number is 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. 5722. Till we hear from you, with us here talking to us, we've got on the line and Amelia Sung. She's a professor of world languages and cultures at American University. Amelia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be here with you.
Cool. And we've also got on the line Concepcion de Leon, a New York Times staff writer for the Books Desk. She also writes a weekly column called El Espace, I think I'm getting that right, where she writes about news and culture for Latinx audience. Hey, Concepcion.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Let's start with Amelia. Amelia, before we go, actually, is it Latinx or is it Latinx?
You know, the jury is still out on that one. What makes the Latinx debate so exciting right now from a sociolinguistic perspective is that it's really still very much evolving in this country. And so questions about how to pronounce it, how widely it's accepted, how to pronounce in Spanish, all of these things are very much being worked out in the minute by minute as people start to adopt and use the term in their daily life.
Well, why don't we start with a little bit of background of Latinx? And I'm thinking even going sort of into history with, like, how do we, like, it's a play off the word Latino, correct? Latino, Latina. How did that term even originate? Were there controversies there? And then how did it morph into Latinx?
Sure. Well, I think a basic point to always keep in mind is that names are very important and powerful because names, they can hurt, they can heal, they can be positive representation, they can also be imposed. And so in the case of Latinx, Latino people, and other minoritized groups in the United States, historically, these names have been imposed by a more powerful group from above, right? And typically carried quite a lot of connotation from those time periods, colonization, racism, exoticization, et cetera, which is why when minoritized groups started pushing back quite strongly against this, with the civil rights movement in the 60s and 70s advocating for equal rights in general, you also saw a push to reject these imposed names and to use names instead that came from within the group. So Latino came as part of that, actually, as a pushback against the idea of Hispanic as a term, because it was felt that Hispanic overemphasized the European connection. So Latino was preferred as a way of emphasizing the Latin American heritage and also making space for people with indigenous descent.
Mm-hmm. And Hispanic because the Spanish is the obvious European connotation there. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. And also Hispanic and Latin America in general, they come from the colonial period. They come from the colonial perspective. So Latino was seen as a way of emphasizing more the Latin American tradition and the indigeneity and mestizo identity.
So we have a new generation of Latinos or Latinxs. Why did they decide that Latino and Latina wasn't the right term?
This is very interesting and exciting from a sociolinguistic point of view, because it really is one of these examples that shows us that language is part of society and vice versa. Words are more than words. So in the case of Latinx, a more inclusive term was sought that would be inclusive for people who identified as Latino descent, but did not identify necessarily with a masculine-feminine binary of gender, which is encoded in the grammar of Spanish. Hence, Latino for people who identify as male, and Latina for people who don't. So an X was put in there as a way of creating a third space or of removing that imposed binary. It actually came out of early queer movements in that community.
Well, that segues right into an audience comment we got from Gisela in Van Nuys. And she called and said, I'm the proud parent of a queer kid who considers themselves Latinx. I find the term inclusive of their community. But Concepcion, you wrote an article about this in November, and you talked to a lot of people, and there were some people who actually had very different points of views. One of them, which I found was most interesting, was that it sort of butchered the Spanish language. And so in your article, you said one reader commented, if you're Spanish speaker, the term Latinx reads like 1,000 nails in 1,000 blackboards. What were some of the other comments you got in terms of pushback of this term?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of comments, some comments from people in Latin America who said that the word was essentially butchering the Spanish language as a whole, and they didn't think that it would ever be adopted in their country. There were some comments that – there was actually one comment that talked about it being sort of being used in a class divide, so essentially that it was an elitist word and that it was mostly used in academic circles and social justice circles and maybe in the media, but not necessarily used – among people who are maybe working class and don't have time. I think the exact words were don't have time to pontificate on like the use of language or the oppression of language or something like that. So there were a lot of responses, and I should say that most of these were on the New York Times Facebook page, and the New York Times audience does skew older. So I thought that was pretty significant, that a lot of the comments that we got were from people that, well, I mean, I can't say for sure that the people were older. I just think that's the case for the New
York. Because they're on Facebook, or no, I'm just kidding. Because I know a lot of the youth are not on Facebook anymore. So you've outlined one divide, older folks versus younger folks who are sort of pushing back against this term, younger folks using it more. Are there any other delights? You flicked at one, divides, you flicked at one, which was elitism. Can you drill down on that a little bit more?
Yeah, that was one. I think that's an area that I spoke to one of the professors about, what was her name? Lourdes Torres. Mm-hmm. So I just spoke to her about it, and she did say, you know, like my mom, my dad, my tia, like they don't use these words. And I will say also on my personal Facebook, I put out a call back, and a lot of the people that responded, my cousins, you know, some people that I know just from where I'm from, like, and they didn't know, they hadn't heard about it either. And those people were younger as well. So they weren't sort of parents or older people. There were people in their 20s and 30s who also hadn't heard of the word. So I think those are two divides. There's the sort of divide between like academic and non-academic spaces, and then there's also the generational divide in terms of age difference.
And I'm wondering, Amelia, is this sort of the normal trajectory of words that get introduced? I'm of an age where I remember when people were still using Oriental, and I introduced Asian American to my parents, and they just didn't understand why we would need to change the word. Real quick, is this just part of the trajectory, or is there something different going on here with Latinx?
It's pretty typical. So in general, a key point here is that languages are always changing. The idea that we often have that languages sort of evolve to a certain perfect point and they should just freeze there and stay there forever is not true. Languages are like people. They're like life. They're constantly changing. And that change is often led by the younger generation, because those are the people who are having new experiences that their parents' generation didn't. They're the people who are coming into contact with new people and ideas, and they're inventing or borrowing words to express these new realities. And so quite often the older generation has other things that they're used to, and so they may not be aware of a term, they may not be plugged into the debates, and when they find out about them, they may resist them because they simply don't see the point. They're comfortable with the term they use. Perhaps they don't want to rock the boat. And sometimes they're also not as plugged in or not as comfortable with the changing social debates about things, you know, in the case of Latinx, like
right.
Gender, reinterpreting gender roles. That
and
may not
it would
be
sort of an acceptance of this gender for a traditionally more socially conservative culture. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'm sorry we've got to leave it here. I want to thank Amelia Sung. She is with the American University in Concepcion de Leon. She's with the New York Times for joining us on this conversation about Latinx. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Queenie Kim sitting in for Larry Mantle, and I will be back tomorrow. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.